This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
The fundamental nature of oil prices in terms of supply and demand over the long haul are not really affected by geopolitics.
Have you forgotten the days of $5 gas from a few years ago? Well, after a period of relatively low prices, the price of the world's most used fossil fuel is on the rise again. Here to explain on Sea Change Radio what's driving the surge in pricing is oil expert Daniel Dicker. We discuss the three main ingredients to understanding the global oil market: supply, demand, and geopolitics. We also delve into the role of renewables, what drivers should expect to pay at the pump in the near future, and why he thinks environmentalists should be rooting for oil prices to reach $300 a barrel. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Dan Dicker. Dan is an oil expert, and his latest project is EnergyWord at dandicker.com. Dan, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. Always great to be with you.
So it was about October of 2016 we had you on. We were on the brink of a lot of sweeping changes. But I always like to have you on when oil prices are on the move, and we've seen a spike recently. I wanted to break this discussion up maybe into three parts to try to get into a better understanding of why oil prices are moving where they are right now. Let's focus on supply, demand, and geopolitics. First, on the supply side, catch us up on where things have moved recently and where do you see shifts in supply in the near future?
So we have been working through a long-term glut in oil supply, which was caused to a large degree by increases in drilling and efficiencies in U.S. shale, and with an OPEC management system which had lost control of production. So with both of these inputs at sort of throttled up to 11, there was a huge glut that found its way into the market over the course of from 2012 to 2014, and it kind of exploded into the market all at once, where we saw prices drop from above $100 a barrel to find lows in the low 30s in February of last year. And since then, on the supply side, much has changed. Obviously, low prices put a tremendous financial pressure on oil companies, and they don't have the cash flow that's required to go out and forget about finding new oil, which is always a constant battle for oil companies, but indeed to continue to pump many of the production lines that they already have going. So, for example, if you are a well manager in some shale play in the United States, I'll take something that really makes a difference, like the Mississippi Lime. But the Mississippi Lime is an expensive shale play that has break even prices, anywhere from $55 to $85 a barrel, which were viable when crude oil is trading over $100 a barrel. But as prices drop, these production lines become small winners, and then ultimately become losers. And you can't obviously keep your company moving forward if you're losing money. So many of these companies with high break-even costs in certain areas have been forced out of business over the course of the last several years. And I think we talked about that when we were on in 2016, because a lot of that kind of whittling away of inefficient oil companies was already, we were in the midst of that battle, if not towards the end of that battle. So there's been a whittling away of supply in various areas. here in the United States from shale plays that and other places where the oil price couldn't sustain that production. And then, of course, there's been a huge concerted effort, mostly from the Saudis inside OPEC, to control production otherwise coming into the global markets, including from the Russians. And in many ways, that has been an incredibly successful effort that ultimately would lead to the kind of ending of the glut, and in fact, certain supply shortages in places that have caused this rise in prices. That is the in a very short, you know, in a capsulized form, what has happened over the last 2 years on the supply side of the equation.
And then let's switch to the demand side. Prices are going up. Is that a reflection at all of competition from renewables, or is it are global prices of oil completely not affected at this point still by the ramping up of renewables around the globe?
You know, to for many of your listeners, I think an unfortunate byproduct that the impact of renewables is still many, many, many years on the horizon. And I'm talking about a global impact of renewables. I mean, we see pockets where there's been tremendous successes and advancements in renewables. But from a mere oil demand standpoint, we are at the stage. Let me preface this by saying, and I always preface it by saying, we have a historical kind of norm of increased demand in oil of around 10 million barrels a day every 10 years. That's an easy metric to kind of think about.
When you say we, is that America or is that the planet?
No, it's global demand. It's global demand for oil. So from 1950 to 1960, you would have seen demand go up by 10 million barrels a day. The 60 to 1970, 10, 80, 90, the aughts, and here in the 2010s. You would see, as a general rule of thumb, oil demand go up 10 million barrels a day every 10 years. And one would think that with the influx of renewables, that demand would start to, in fact, level off and drop at some point. We would call that the peak demand argument, as opposed to a peak supply argument, which we've talked about several times in the past. But that would be a peak demand argument. And what we see is quite the opposite, that in fact, over the course of the last 2 years, and in fact, for projections moving forward for the next at least 6 or 7, that demand is not a million barrels, you know, going up a million barrels a year, you know, or 10 million barrels over 10 years, but it's in fact doing 1.5 times that we have seen demand increase 2015, 2016, 2017, 2018, anywhere from 1.2 to 1.6 million barrels a day a year. And that is projected to maintain itself at least for the next 4 or 5 years. Projections past that, it's really hard to tell. So at least for us in the near term, if we would like to think of the next 5 years as a near term, renewables are really not having much of an impact on demand. In fact, demand is actually working in an opposite direction. It's accelerating at this point.
And what do you attribute that to?
Well, I mean, there is an enormous global growth going on, not here in the United States, where demand is actually slackening slowly, and in Europe, where it's slackening quite a bit. But in the Middle East, in Africa, in China, in India, in parts of Eastern Europe, in Indonesia, Southeast Asia, they are, you know, they're trying to catch up in many ways to the U.S. and Europe in terms of technological and, energy needs. And that has been fueling the global increase in oil and hydrocarbon products for the last several years, whereas, you know, we had always looked at the United States and Europe as being the drivers of demand, and China, of course, you know, in the last several years. China continues to increase demand, India increases demand, but all these places that we thought, you know, that are basically coming from zero in terms of demand are very quickly looking to catch up to the Europeans or as fast as they can in Africa and the Middle East. And that's really what's been the driver of demand.
Underneath the shadows of the smokestack road, you can't see the stars or the clouds below. They're calling it the Richmond Refinery, I'm calling it a mess of the worst degree.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to oil expert Dan Dicker. So Dan, investors tend to look at WTI, West Texas Intermediate, and Brent crude prices as kind of the benchmark for where prices are. Why don't you give us a little recap of the last 18 months, if you can, of where prices have gone. Where were they last time we spoke in October of 2016?
Right. So you know, we reached kind of the low point of near to $30 a barrel, you know, right around early 2016. And since then, you know, we've been now, these were unsustainable prices. And I know I mentioned that to you. I don't know when the last time we were on. Was it October? Is that when it was?
Yes.
Probably hovering near about $50 a barrel then. And many thought that this was the new normal in oil prices. And I was not of that belief at all. But many thought that this was, that we would now see a new age of renewables that would, one famous analyst, commodity analyst, Dennis Gartman, believed that we were at the moment when oil would go the way of whale oil, and that we would be overtaken by renewables. And that oil was, in fact, finished as a primary source of fuel, and we weren't going to see prices very much above $50. But instead of that, of course, my thesis was back then, and is now being played out, that the low price of oil would again go make for a very typical cycling of producers. In other words, driving those less efficient ones out of business. Forcing a lack of investment for new oil to be found, causing a supply shortage. And provided that, you know, as I said, the demand picture didn't change for oil, that ultimately we would reach a spot where there was going to be an enormous spike in prices. And I didn't know exactly when that would happen. And in fact, I was wrong by about, almost a year as to when those prices would begin to spike, because I thought by the end of 16 we would have already begun to see that spike, when in fact we didn't really go on a tear upwards in oil prices until, you know, late September, October of 2017, when we finally took off above $50. And now, you know, even above 70, to me the oil price is looking very, very strong and likely to increase over the course of the next 2 years, going well above $100 a barrel.
If we could extend that timeline to 2 or 3 years, what are we looking at? At some point, when do you start looking to sell, if you're a trader?
Right. Well, again, this is always tough to predict where the bust comes. But again, the cycling is, not unique. So a higher drive on prices will ultimately lead to more production in many of these, less efficient areas, those that need $60, $70 break-even prices in order to make money. And ultimately, when enough money goes into developing those resources and we get again to a point where the market is completely glutted with high-quality, expensive crude, we will know we'll try to know, but it's very difficult to actually know precisely when it happens that we've reached near the top of the marketplace. So, and I guess this is the third part of your question, which we could get into now. You know, we talk about geopolitical issues that impact what's going on with the oil price. But the fundamental nature of oil prices in terms of supply and demand over the long haul are not really affected by geopolitics.
I guess also the definition of geopolitics is important here. I mean, when we talk about a country like Venezuela, for example, huge oil reserves, but a country in disarray, would that be under the umbrella of geopolitics to a trader?
Yeah, I for sure. I mean, there's been a huge issue. You know, right now, ConocoPhillips, for example, is in process of trying to take assets out of Venezuela that are not theirs. And, you know, there has been, again, this kind of cycling of money into resources extends not only into shale plays, but into foreign nations. So that's the way I kind of try to look at it. You know, where does money from oil companies and investors and shareholders go in order to develop fresh oil supplies? Because remember, oil is always an eroding resource. You drill a well, you take the oil out, that well is spent, you have to find another well. This is the oil business. It's always like this. So there's always money that needs to come in, chase fresh resources, whether it's in a shale play or in a foreign nation. And the issues that many American and European oil companies have had in the past and continue to have when their money chases assets in foreign nations is part of the geopolitical struggle for traders to try and understand. In Venezuela, in Brazil, in Russia, for example, in Uzbekistan. I mean, there's been so many of these in Nigeria.
And do you think these renewed sanctions that the Trump administration is talking about in Iran will have much of an impact on global prices? I'd imagine probably not.
The idea of fresh Iranian sanctions, at least right now, is really going to have minimal effect on global oil because the Iranians have not been able to develop all that much more in terms of what they've been able to pump since sanctions came off 2.5 years ago. They've increased maybe 400,000 or 500,000 barrels a day. And in fact, they have tremendous outlet for that anyway, as these sanctions are not being universally applied anymore. You know, the Chinese won't go back to applying sanctions. The Indians won't go back to applying sanctions. The Japanese won't go back to applying sanctions. Iranian crude will find many roads out of the country now that they weren't able to find before sanctions were relieved 2.5 years ago under John Kerry and President Obama.
And I've read that the Saudis have pushed for higher prices as well and have limited production because they're interested in a lot of domestic spending, infrastructure spending on their behalf. How does that play a role in the price in your estimation?
Yeah, this is without question the biggest story in the global energy market and maybe in the Middle East in its entirety. And we're talking about, you know, the power grab, power struggle, turnover in power to the young Mohammed bin Salman, known by a sobriquet MBS, who has, you know, locked up many of his own family members and has also opened up in many ways some of the social freedoms in Saudi Arabia, is really trying to remake the country into one that is not solely reliant upon oil sheiks and oil revenues. And the keystone of that plan is an IPO of the state-owned Saudi Aramco, which in essence is a public offering of Saudi Arabian oil assets. And that has been the overwhelming focus of bin Salman for the last 3 years, before he took control of power and was part of, you know, the older king's plan to revitalize or change over the control of oil assets from the old guard to the new guard. And what we have found, or what I think I see, is that the entire program of limiting production since late 2015 when it started to now helping to drive prices upwards into the 70s and hopefully for them $80, $90, $100 is all about getting the best valuation for their one lone asset, and that is their oil wells, their oil potential in Saudi Arabia. And with a good result for that IPO, it will make the difference on whether MBS can complete his plans on changing the economy and the social structure in Saudi Arabia. To me, that is, without question, the most ignored, yet the most important story in the Middle East. Singular, bar none, forgetting about everything else that's going on in the Middle East. The ability or inability of the prince to change the economy and the social look
fabric.
And fabric, right, of Saudi Arabia is going to be the story that needs to be followed for the next 5 years. That's the key story in the Middle East. It will affect everything. Iran, Iraq, Israel, Palestinians, Egypt, everything will be affected by whether this prince can turn the corner and reach the 21st century in Saudi Arabia.
And then, of course, the orange elephant in the room in the White House right now, Wall Street has reacted to his presidency in fairly measured terms. But when you're talking about geopolitics not necessarily affecting your work and the work of oil traders, the fear that a lot of rational people have is that America is no longer a stable nation, and then we could see ourselves diving into another Iraq war. There's this saber rattling in Iran. Just basically, our foreign policy is a little bit off the rails, to say the least, when you have somebody like John Bolton, National Security Advisor. So in following this, Dan, how have oil experts kind of been able to deal with this new era of craziness, for lack of a better word?
I don't know if this is Trump's problem alone, but in the Middle East, it's been fairly clear since, the invasion of Iraq, even, that the Americans were not as capable of imposing their will, or in fact following up on their plans everywhere in the Middle East. So there's less confidence in the Palestinians, for example, that they can apply a two-state solution ever. Or there's the latest results in Iraq, putting a Shiite back into power, and in essence, destroying the representation of the Sunni minority, and perhaps making Iraq, a complete arm of the Iranians, or in the structuring of the Iran nuclear deal under Kerry and Obama, where the Saudis were clearly thought of themselves as an ally of the United States and saw this as a tremendous hurt against their ability to control the geopolitics of the region. So I think that everywhere you look in Syria, for example, right, where the genocide that's going on hasn't been controlled, or even in many ways even attempted to be controlled by the United States under either administration, Obama's or ours. So I think from an oil point of view, what we're seeing and what we have been seeing over the long haul, not taking anything away from the stupidity of the current president and his ridiculous ideas on foreign policy, because I don't want to in any way give him credit for anything, but the United States relationship to the Middle East has been falling apart for quite a long time. And as an oil trader, you certainly have to take a case-by-case basis and not rely upon American foreign policy to inform what you think is going to happen there in terms of oil, global oil.
You're not trying to get woman everything and what she need. That's why she don't do nothing, man, but lay up in the bed and read. You know she walk just like she got all wells in her backyard. Yeah, never heard a woman hooping, hollering, crying. No man talking about these times being hard.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to oil expert Dan Dicker. His latest work can be found at EnergyWord at dandicker.com. So Dan, just taking a smaller view of gas prices right now in the U.S. for listeners who are wondering why they're paying X amount when they go to the pump. I live in San Francisco. I see that the cheapest gas prices near me are $3.89 a gallon. And then my father lives in New Orleans. His cheapest gas prices are $2.39 a gallon. That's a huge disparity, and I've heard that it's because of refinery costs and shipping costs, but maybe you can break down that enormous disparity. How much would you attribute it to refinery, distribution, and tax?
Well, California has certain air requirements that other states don't. So that's a premium there. And but past that, it's almost entirely, as you say, it's mostly geographical, because most of the gasoline that's refined in this country is refined in the South, around the Gulf Coast. And there's some on the East Coast, but it's small compared to what goes on in the South. And so if you have a direct pipeline, a very cheap direct pipeline from somewhere, if you either live in the South or you have a direct pipeline that's pretty close to the South, your transport costs are going to be less and, you know, gas is going to be cheaper because you got to pay for pipe. And that's, you know, basically it. But in terms of, you know, a national kind of viewpoint on gas prices, they're going up. I'm sorry, folks, but they're going to continue to go up. And you should prepare for that because, you know, you're looking at whatever, I think a national price of somewhere around $3 a gallon. And I think you're going to see $4 by the end of the year.
And with that, we get into the conundrum of rising gas prices are hitting the most vulnerable. That's bad. But also rising gas prices may stimulate more fuel economical cars, people more willing to invest in solar panels, et cetera, right?
I have, you know, and we've been on, I don't know how many times, this is maybe my third or fourth interview with you, Alex. And I, you know, and I'm sure that your listeners listen to me and say this and they think I'm totally cracked. But if you are a believer in renewable energy and you are a fan of renewable energy and you want this country, if not the world, to move towards renewable energy, you don't want $100 oil. You want $300 oil. Because it is the economics of renewables that are going to push them forward faster. And the higher the price of oil, the more less economically challenged many of these renewable technologies become. It's as simple as that.
Dan Dicker, thanks for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Johnny Otis and Ella Fitzgerald.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.